Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Although smell is very important to us, few of us understand how smelling works or why this sense shapes our reality so profoundly. Journalist Jude Stewart has written a guidebook to smell and takes readers on a fascinating journey into the weird and wonderful world of smell, the least understood of our five senses. Jude Stewart writes about design and culture for Slate, The Believer, and Design Observer, and is a contributing editor at Print Magazine. She is author of a book about color, Roy G. Biv, and now has written Revelations in Air, a guidebook to smell. Jude Stewart, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Nancy. It's great to be here.
You know, I don't know that it's very often that I read a book that changes the way I do things, but this morning I washed a load of laundry and I took it outside and hung it in the sunshine instead of putting it in a dryer. And I don't think I would have considered that. I maybe hung it somewhere else, but I put it in the sunshine. And you explain in your book the difference that makes. Tell listeners, what difference does it make if you hang your clothes in sunshine?
Well, there was actually a scientist that studied this, which is really a scientist after my own heart. That's exactly the sort of question I want sometimes out of science. So why are beautiful things happening? And she found some interesting things. She noticed, first off, that there is a definite difference. So she was able to isolate with the same sheets. You know, she put them under different treatments, and one of them was just being outside, drying in the free air. And she was able to explain a few things, and one of which is that maybe sunshine seems to draw out certain aldehydes, which is a natural kind of aromatic compound, so that it actually sort of pumps that aspect of the smell up a bit more. So we're perceiving that a bit. But I think the reason why we find it to be such a great smell is because it just evokes the outdoors. You know, inside your folded up laundry drawer, it's nice to have that whiff.
Well, another difference reading your book made is a few days ago, I was riding through the countryside and the fields were plowed, and my normal reaction might have been, oh, this is pretty boring. But instead, I rolled down the window and sniffed the air. And what would you expect to smell, Jude?
What was outside your window in the car?
Plowed fields.
Plowed fields. Oh, yes. Well, I would think probably you're smelling that beautiful kind of contents of the ground, the earth that's been opened up. I love that you did that first off, and I love that you're opened up your sniffer. I gotta congratulate you right there, because that has been the main effect for me of writing this book is it's just a really simple difference of just registering the smells that are actually there all the time, and it's had the effect of kind of slowing me down in different situations that I'm in, even simple ones like that. I wondered if next time you do that, maybe you can think about, oh, I wonder what's in that earth, right? Because some earth has more clay components or more sand or what have you. You know, if there have been recently a rain, then you're going to have probably more smells coming out, because smell works better when conditions are kind of warm and humid. Next time you do that, just think, see if you can challenge yourself to sort of compare and contrast between the different times.
Well, part of the problem is that we lack vocabulary for smells, Jude. In fact, we sometimes kind of laugh at wine snobs because they use all these adjectives for the wine. You think, oh, yeah, sure. But we don't really have enough adjectives, I don't think, to describe what we're experiencing. So when I was riding and smelling the plowed fields, about the only adjective that came to mind was earthy. It smelled like the earth. But what other adjectives have you encouraged us to maybe explore?
Well, you're absolutely right about that. In fact, you're so right about that there's a term for it, for this phenomenon, which is called the olfactory verbal gap. And it's that difficulty that we have of putting a name on a smell. That we might smell it and recognize it, but not know how to even label it. So in your case, you knew you were smelling earth, and it's the second level of that is, oh goodness, what else can I say besides earthy? And I encountered that over and over. You'd smell, sit down to smell something. And, you know, each of my chapters opens up with a kind of evocation of the smell in words. And those are so hard to write because the first thing you want to say is, smells like peppermint, smells like lavender.
You know? Yes, that's done. Because that's what it done. Is.
Exactly.
Well, you do give us exercises along with your chapters on these various smells. You give us exercises to do. And I think once people read your exercises, they can probably come up with some of their own. Say, here's what I'm going to do to experience this smell. What's an example of some of the exercises that you tell us to cultivate our sense of smell?
I believe with one of them, it was collecting, you know, if you have a lot of one type of thing in your kitchen cupboard, like I have a lot of different vinegars for some reason. If you just pour a little bit out of each of them into small glasses and then smell them each at turn, that is really revelatory in a kind of quiet way because they do all smell like vinegar, but then you can distinguish these different notes between them. So it becomes discernible.
I do remember that exercise because I think I haven't done it yet. But I thought, I'm going to do that because I have various vinegars that I enjoy, but I hadn't thought of comparing the smell. Maybe like sometimes people put wine bottles in a bag and see if their guests can identify them. I think that would be fun to do with vinegar.
Yeah, there you go.
My guest is Jude Stewart, and she has written a book, Revelations in Air, a Guidebook to Smell. And we were talking about, say, riding through the countryside and smelling the earth. But your section on pine, the smell of pine, I thought it was a really nice fact that the Japanese have a word for forest bathing. When you stroll through a forest and you pay attention to the smell, and it's more than just smelling, you say that strolling through a forest can improve your well-being.
Yeah.
So what are we smelling if we walk through, if we indulge in forest bathing?
Well, forests actually kind of create their own kind of microclimate. There's been some evidence to suggest that they repel different aspects of the light rays that are coming in, and they can kind of subtly cool down the environment just by virtue of like the terpenes that are being thrown off by the trees. So it's not just the shade of the actual, you know, branches over your head, but there's a sort of invisible chemical shield, if you will. So there's a real sense of that coolness and that kind of steady kind of alternate universe that exists when you're walking through pine trees that is not entirely in your head. So next time you do that, just be aware of, you know, the alternate state that the pine trees are creating for you.
Well, you also tell us that 500 years ago, Jacques Cartier's crew was saved from scurvy by making pine tea. So what do you make pine tea out of? Because I'd never thought about, if you'd ask me what's a good source of vitamin C, I don't think I would think of pine bark and needles.
Yes. Well, I cannot recommend a specific recipe, so I would encourage you to look that up on your own. But yes, it's true what you said about the anecdote that they are surprisingly high in vitamin C, pine needles. So it's possible to make a tea. And as we all know from stories along these lines, I mean, scurvy, when it does hit on long sea voyages, is really debilitating. People's teeth fall out and they have like bruises and open sores on their arms and legs. And, you know, you feel really wobbly and terrible. So it is possible to repair all those things pretty much in a twinkling if you can get a good jolt of vitamin C. So pine needles, at least on one famous occasion, have done that magic for people.
My guest is journalist Jude Stewart, and her book is a guidebook to smell. And when you ask people if they have a favorite smell or a smell they really don't like, I can understand why there would not be agreement. Because, for example, most of us, a smell brings back memories. I mean, there's a memory associated with it that influences our feeling about it. And, for example, I think skunk would be the last, close to the bottom of the list of smells that people would want to indulge in. But when I was growing up, my brother had a pet skunk. So my feeling about skunk, not the smell really, but is an adorable little animal that stamps his feet and is just so adorable that that I have a different feeling about that. But what smell do people not like? Or maybe what smell do you not like?
What smell do I not like? Well, I love thinking about your baby skunk friend. That's delightful. And the interesting thing about skunks is that they do give you a lot of warning if they're going to spray you. So it's should not come as an accident.
Yeah. You know, I was surprised at that they warn you. And so mostly I know of dogs that get sprayed. And of course they ignore the signals that the skunk is giving. Stay away, Buster. So what smell do you say not like, or do other people not like?
Let's see. I was surprised that I wasn't really wild about smelling rose or jasmine, even though they're sort of objectively beautiful smells. I mean, yeah. I got that they were attractive. It's just that I kind of exhausted on the smell of both of those kind of quickly. And you know, when you're writing a book about smells, you're spending like a couple of days with the smell. So you hit the wall eventually. What was surprising is I really, go ahead.
Mm-hmm, go ahead. What was surprising?
What was surprising is I actually could not get enough of the smell of tobacco, not burning tobacco, but like kind of from the tin pipe tobacco. I really was very pleased with how that filled the room and the varieties with that and everything. And then when I examined, well, why would I feel that way? I'm not a smoker. I realized, well, you know, my family grew up in Kentucky and, you know, and I went to school in North Carolina. I have a lot of good associations with curing tobacco and tobacco fields and that sort of thing. So,
well, when I was a kid, I had some of my toys, like doll things, in a cigar box. So I have a kind of a fond feeling about the smell of cigars.
Nice.
And it's
nice.
Like your feeling about tobacco. Now, I also didn't feel like I was part of the crowd with the universally loved smell. You tell us that the universally loved smell is vanilla. And I thought, oh gosh, it seems like every time if I want to buy a candle, they're all scented vanilla. And I thought, oh gosh, that's just too sweet. But then when I mentioned that to a friend, he said, well, they're not real vanilla, they're artificial. And is that true?
Yes, that's probably true. Most smells, in fact, are for the most part no longer derived from natural ingredients, but they very often are synthesized. And that's, you know, for environmental reasons as much as anything else. But no, it's interesting with vanilla because it suffers from this weird status. It's sort of a victim of its own success because I don't know if it's universally loved so much as it's very inoffensive and universally kind of liked. And there are a couple of reasons for that. It rounds out other flavors really nicely. So you notice in a lot of baking recipes, you just put in a little vanilla, even though the thing itself isn't intended to smell like vanilla. It also is unusual in that it doesn't activate these nerves in our face and nose that are called the trigeminal nerve system. And those are the ones that are activated for you when you cut up onions or smell like a really hot pepper, something like that. And sometimes that reaction of those nerves is not super pleasant. So to not activate the nerves is to remove the main obstacle of disliking something usually.
Well, here's another example of how reading your book changes maybe the decisions that I make, because I was thinking, oh, vanilla, that candle is just too much. But then I read in your book that vanilla can ease muscle pain, reduce stress headaches, quell anxiety during MRIs. Now, I don't know that doctors use that, but I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. Because I do know that they ask people, what kind of music do you like? Would you like us to play you some classical music while you undergo the MRI? So maybe people read your book and docs will say, let's put a little vanilla in the MRI room.
It's not a bad idea.
You also say that that vanilla calms the startle reflexes and eases sleep apnea.
Yes.
And can help with male impotence. Wow, that sounds good.
I mean, sign me up for all of those things. It sounds excellent.
Yeah, so I'm going to reconsider how I view vanilla now, thanks to you, Jude.
Thank you.
My guest is Jude Stewart, and she has written a guidebook to smell, Revelations in Air. And there's another actually it's edible, so I do like the smell, but I love ginger. And after I read your book, I was thinking, oh golly, if other people read her book, maybe I shouldn't admit how much I like ginger and the smell, because you tell us about an 11th century Benedictine monk, a monk of all people now. And what did he write about ginger?
Oh my. So his name was Constantine of Africa, and he wrote the premier sex manual in the 11th century that was going around Europe. And it includes a lot of recipes. They would call them electuaries, and they are recipes for, you know, how to get yourself or someone else in the mood. And many of them include ginger. So yes, this is a surprisingly sexy association with that, that smell.
Yeah, and I was surprised it was a monk that was writing.
I know,
this.
Yes. Indeed, he must have been a good time. I wonder how good of a monk he was, but he was certainly good on other fronts.
Smell expert Jude Stewart and I will be back to continue our conversation after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Jude Stewart has written a guidebook to smell. You have a chapter or section on skin, and you mention the role of smell in mating, for example. And so they would offer people t-shirts to smell. And I was intrigued by the fact that they offered t-shirts to gay men to identify. And what was that experiment? What was the nature of that experiment, Jude?
Oh, I love this chapter. I'm so glad you brought it up, Nancy. The smell of your skin is giving off a lot of information about your body, whether or not you're getting certain diseases, your moods, and also the state of your immune system, how robust your immune system is. And it's also to some degree probably giving up information about your sexuality. So if you're heterosexual, then you might be choosing your mate for many reasons. And one of them might be that they smell good. And what that is you, the two of you recognizing that your immune systems are robustly different from each other. So your offspring would be very powerful. But on the gay side of things, that's obviously not a reason why people are choosing their mates. But this particular study was they asked gays and lesbians in different cohorts to smell the t-shirts of other people. And there was strong evidence to find that the gay men could smell the other gay men through their t-shirts, and they preferred those smells. And the same was true of the lesbian cohort.
Yeah, in fact, there's so much that we learn about smell in your book that is pretty surprising. And if we only knew these things, maybe we could put it to use. For example, with COVID, this was typical all over. And at my job, first thing you did, you walk in the door, you got your temperature taken. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in your book that there's a better predictor than a temperature check. And what's that better predictor of, say, COVID than checking someone's temperature?
Whether or not you can smell certain things. So I read one study that suggested that in terms of the different symptoms, many of which are quite generic for COVID, sudden loss of smell was 22 times more likely than any other predictor, including the temperature checks, of accurately saying, okay, yes, you have COVID and you should quarantine immediately. So it's interesting. There is quite a lot of work around creating different rapid smell tests that are available in different settings to sort of have a low-tech way to kind of check whether or not people's smellers are working, because it is such a good predictor.
Well, I had heard that people, when they come down with COVID, do lose your sense of smell, but I didn't realize that it could be a predictor.
Right, exactly.
Now, another thing that surprised me was that peanut butter, the smell of peanut butter, can be used to diagnose cognitive decline. For example, I just imagine somebody suspecting maybe grandmother is coming down with Alzheimer's or developing symptoms, and you could offer her the smell of peanut butter.
Exactly. Yes, that's a really crazy one. Because apparently they're not only is sniffing peanut butter a way to determine, it's one of many ways to sort of confirm a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, but there's a difference between the two different nostrils. I will admit that I forget which one is the predicting one. You have to get the book and find out. But one of them in particular is the dead giveaway. If you can't smell it in that nostril, then it's really... It is among the many kind of diagnostic points that they're looking for to determine this Alzheimer's.
Well, you do tell us that sudden shifts in body odor will give you clues about your health. And what are some of those, Jude?
Well, there's quite a few diseases that can be predicted by how your body smells. So Parkinson's disease, melanomas, a couple different types of cancers, in fact, multiple sclerosis, and COVID actually is also one that they're now training dogs to be able to smell on someone's person. So, and it sounds very kind of futuristic that we would be able to know this, but in fact, there's a really long history of diagnosis by smell, by bodily smell. Typhus, I think, is known from its smell of overripe apples, if I'm remembering that correctly. There are a couple other associators that way. So it's a long time coming. Measles, I believe, could be diagnosed by the smell of freshly plucked feathers, if you know what that smell is, which I do not.
I don't either. But now when you're mentioning that, it comes to mind that animals often know when their owners are starting to have some kind of physical problem. And I think most people know that dog's sense of smell is far superior to ours. And so it makes you wonder, maybe we should be training dogs for more smell detection than we do already. You just mentioned that they can be taught to sniff out COVID. What do you think about taking advantage of the fact that dogs have a natural, a greater sense of smell than we do anyway? It seems like they could be trained to help us detect health problems.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that. It's interesting how many anecdotes I came across online of people whose dogs wouldn't let go of, you know, sniffing their leg in a certain place, and then they come to find out, you know, they'd go to the doctor and it would be a melanoma there, so that freckle really was problematic, and the dog knew it first. So there is something to be said for that. Doctors can also learn how to use their noses and diagnosis. There's a famous woman whose husband had Parkinson's disease, and she was able to determine that smell very early on. She noticed that his bodily smell was different, and she became the subject of some study because doctors wanted to understand what it was that she was picking up so early. And then there are also technological solutions. So electronic noses already exist to sense whether or not, for example, there's you know, if you're at a food factory, if there's spoilage or if there's a leak in a nuclear power plant, then an electronic nose can pick that up. So there's no reason why an electronic nose couldn't also be able to sniff out certain smells of disease.
Mm. My guest is journalist Jude Stewart, and she's written a guidebook to smell. And you mentioned, we were just talking about dogs, but we wonder sometimes how animals, I mean, a cat will find its way home from, or a dog, find its way home from miles and miles away. Do they use their sense of smell?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's fascinating to look into the world of how dogs and many different animals sort of use their sense of smell to really build a picture of the world, to navigate, to understand, you know, information about their surroundings and people and community. So when dogs are really fascinated on their walk by, you know, how the same tree smells over and over, it's a different smell every time because different dogs are going by, and those dogs may or may not be in heat. They may or may not be healthy. They might be a new dog. So you got to check it out every time. I read one book called Being a Dog by Alexandra Horowitz that I thought was so interesting. It was all about how dogs construct their sense of the world through smell. And it explained why dogs know when you're going to come home from work every day.
Rupert Sheldrake wrote a book about that.
Oh, really?
Are you familiar with Rupert Sheldrake's book? Yes.
Ooh.
Dogs who know when their owners are coming home.
Oh.
And they did all sorts of, they changed it around so that to not exactly fool the dog, but to say, how does the dog know this? And it's quite a fascinating book. Anyway, Rupert Sheldrake. Want to check
that cool.
Out.
I will check that out.
So animals are able to do this, able to navigate, or they have a sense of time. And if smell is so important, I can just see how companies would say, hey, you know what? We should trademark this smell. Is that possible?
It is. I do write about the smell of Play-Doh, which is probably the most famous trademarked smell out there. And it was pretty interesting to get into that because, you know, first thing you have to understand what the difference is between a trademark and a patent. So a patent is covers a product's functionality. So a product is made to do X or Y, and if it does it well, then the patent protects that. A trademark, though, is about non-functionality. It's about these intangible qualities that let you know that what you're buying is the true product that you think you're buying. So it's real Play-Doh, and you know that because of the smell. So I looked into this for perfume. I'm like, all right, well, is Chanel No. 5 trademarked or patented? And the answer is it's trademarked. Its bottle is trademarked. Its name and all the trappings of its brand are trademarked. But the actual perfume is not patented because, for one thing, what is the function of perfume? It's a little hard to pin that one down. And for another thing, the whole patent process is very dependent on a lot of submitting of documentations and telling everyone exactly what's in your formula and exactly what's there. And then perfume industry is a little loath to do that. So that was an interesting kind of sideline into learning some things through smell.
Yeah, it made me curious to smell some Play-Doh next time I have an opportunity. I never smelled it that I recall. We were talking about animals being able to pick up smells. And I always feel sorry when I see somebody walking their dog and the little dog wants to smell along the walk and the owner's just pulling it along and I just say, oh no, let that little dog smell. He really would like to explore the world of olfactory world. But I also think that, and I used to wonder how dogs seem to pick up emotion because one time an old college roommate visited me and her dad had just died. We sat up talking and when we went off to bed, my little dog always slept with me, but that evening he crawled in bed with this stranger. And it was as if, I know you're suffering, dear, and I want to comfort you. And you say that emotions have a smell attached to them. What are some of these emotions that can be smelled?
I love that little anecdote. And it's a crazy thought to realize that we can smell each other's emotions. So the ones where I found studies were detectable through smell were joy, fear, and disgust. And two different studies, they both involved watching movies. So one group of people would watch a movie eliciting the smell or the movies that were designed to elicit a sense of fear. Another group was watching a movie. It was designed to make them feel disgusted. And so they were wearing t-shirts. The t-shirts were taken off and then presented to another group of people. And the question was, you know, which can you smell, which is which? And the answers was pretty overwhelmingly yes, that they could discern the differences between the fear and the disgust t-shirts. And moreover, that there's a well-established pattern of how our faces react when you are disgusted or fearful. And it's, so it's sort of a pre-verbal confirmation. You don't even need to ask me, do I smell fear, for my face to register it. And so that was actually what they were looking for in that study. And they did find that confirmation. And then the other study that I'm thinking of, some group of people were asked to watch Disney's Jungle Book, which is a very happy-making kind of movie, and then some of the more hair-raising scenes from The Shining. So that was the fear group. And so again, people were wearing the t-shirts while they watched these movies, and then the t-shirts were removed and given to another group of people. And again, the people were able to discern the differences, not just in verbal identification, but in the way that their faces reacted to the smells.
Well, you know, I recall now that when you were listing the emotions that humans can smell, one of those emotions was sadness. And so I'm just thinking my little dachshund smelled maybe sadness in my former roommate. And she wrote me afterwards that she went out and got a dog and got a dachshund.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. So just to finish that story, you have, I think, such an interesting topic. How did you even decide you wanted to investigate smell? Because you had a career otherwise, design. You didn't have to be studying, researching smell. How did you get off on this track?
That's a great question, Nancy. You know, I've written for a long time about graphic design and about visual culture, and I still really love all those things. But on some level, I think images weren't quite doing it for me in the same way as they had been. And I don't even know if I was consciously aware of that, but I did happen to go to an art exhibit that was organized around smells, and I found it to just be so viscerally affecting. I mean, in a good and a bad sense, like I would smell these smells and it would be alternately exhilarating or disturbing, or, you know, I just felt like my skin had been peeled back and I thought, good Lord, this is very powerful. And I don't know anything about this sense of smell. I haven't really even been cluing into it. And basically when I looked into it, I realized, golly, that smell is this terra incognita that's all around me. My nose has these latent superpowers that are literally have been under, not just under my nose, but inside of it. So it was quite involving to get into.
Well, June, before I say goodbye, I would like to mention that your dedication to joy, some of the joy. And I thought it's really a compliment because you say one of the best little stinkers I know. And I thought about the fact, yeah, stinkers can be a compliment.
Well, I try to lean into the smell puns. I mean, if you're going to write a book about smell, you got to have a sense of humor, right, Nancy?
Yes, I agree.
Hopefully Joy does too.
Well, thank you for writing this book. I think people will be intrigued and will want to do some of these exercises that you include in your book for us. Thank you, Jude.
Well, thank you for having me, Nancy. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. My guest has been journalist Jude Stewart, and she has written a guidebook to smell, Revelations in Air. When we come back, Taoist scholar Bill Martin tells about the Tao of Forgiveness. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio.
In Chico, there is a center for Zen practice called The Still Point, and its founder is best-selling author William Martin. Bill is author of four books, including The Parents' Tao Te Ching and A Path and a Practice, and now he's just written his fifth book, The Tao of Forgiveness. Bill Martin, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, you have a really hot topic now when you talk about Zen, because anytime I pick up a newspaper, I don't care what section I turn to. If it's a sports section, they're talking about a book called Zen Golf.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or Tiger Woods going back to his Buddhist roots.
Okay.
Or I look, the fashion section, Donna Karan has a collection called Urban Zen.
Oh, yeah.
And anywhere you look, you can come across these references to it. But I wonder, do we really understand what we're talking about so much?
Well, I certainly don't. it's obviously an overused phrase. Both words, Tao and Zen, are attached to everything under the sun.
And you know, another place I found it was an article about Apple, and here's this computer company, and they talk about the techno-Zen aspects of this new product is going to please everybody. So techno-Zen.
No, I hadn't heard techno-Zen before. Yeah. That one really frightens me because for personal reasons. But I can only go back to our own understanding of of both the word Tao and Zen as we practice it here at the Still Point. Our center is called Still Point, a center for Zen practice. But as we describe ourselves, we're a center for the practice of conscious, compassionate awareness in the Taoist Zen tradition.
Now, you put both those words
together. We put both of those words together because Zen is a Japanese word that literally means meditation, sitting in meditation. And it comes from the Chinese word Chan, which also means meditation. And its roots, although it's influenced by Buddhism, its roots are deeply Taoist. Taoism, T-A-O, Taoism is both a religion and a philosophy, 3,000-4,000 years old in China. We're in the strain of the philosophical Taoist thought, it's not a religion, but a philosophy expressed by Lao Tzu, the author of the Tao Te Ching 2,500 years ago. And when Buddhism came over into China in the first millennia, it met the already established philosophical Taoism, and the two blended together to become what was called Chan. And then when that went to Japan, it was called Zen. It's essentially Taoism with a little bit of Buddhism thrown in. Now, today it has all sorts of implications. There are very, very Buddhist Zen groups. There are groups like ours, which are very much more Taoist Zen. We emphasize the Taoist roots because it's much more accessible. It makes us less like a religion and more like a practice of compassionate awareness, of living life with direct experience and intensity and playfulness and joy. And it's that Taoist root that gives what our practice of Zen a sense of realistic, sensual delight in life. You can notice the difference in lots of Buddhist traditions. The statues of Buddha from the lots of Southeast Asian and Indian traditions are very thin and erect and fairly imposing. If there's a smile, it's just kind of a little hint of an enigmatic smile. In the Taoist Zen tradition, Buddhas are fat and sitting kind of squat, and it's not a smile, it's just a full belly laugh. And that's that Taoist root of this is life. This isn't some sort of mind game escape from life. This is just life lived in an ordinary, intense, direct way.
My guest is Taoist scholar and Zen teacher, Bill Martin, and we're talking about his newest book, The Tao of Forgiveness, but we really haven't talked about that book yet because we have to understand some of this terminology before we can even talk about the Tao of Forgiveness.
Okay.
So you've been helping us to understand this notion of Zen, and when Tiger Woods says he wants to get back to his Buddhist roots, I would imagine it's not this, I don't know, maybe it is.
I have no idea.
But
I can't speak for more traditional Buddhist expressions. In our center, we have three little statues. One is of Buddha, and he's facing the wall. Mm-hmm. And this is our expression that he is there as our example and teacher of the inner journey, of the root practice of meditation and examining the way our conditioned mind works. Then we have a little statue of Lao Tzu, and he's facing outward, and that's to connect us with the sensual pleasure of life. And a third statue of the Chinese goddess Kuan Yin, who's a representation of the essential compassionate nature. And so in our practice, those three statues go together: the inner journey, the outer connection with life, and conscious, compassionate awareness that bind the two together and allow us to live a life of kindness and gentleness.
Well, at one point when you wrote the sentence in your book that experiences in life, and you said events in life, repeat themselves, and it instantly called to mind an expression by our Spanish writer, Azorín, who said, vivir es ver volver, to live is to see return. As you live, you see these cycles of life that repeat themselves. And so that's one thing that you, a point you make in your book, that it's not linear.
No, it's not. It's a very complex, well, it's a very complex experience, isn't it? And things that you thought you learned, here they come again. Things that have disappeared are back again. Old feelings are back. Old connections are back. Old memories. Here I am again. Here I am doing this again. Why am I doing this again?
Well, in your book, you suggest that a reader picks up The Tao of Forgiveness, which is your newest book. This is your fifth book. When they open a copy of The Tao of Forgiveness, you recommend that they have a companion book along with them. And that's kind of what I've been wanting to do right now, is to give listeners an idea of what this notion is, the background for why they would want to pick up and read a copy of The Tao of Forgiveness. So what other book do you suggest that they have handy?
I suggested that they have a companion book. Okay. See, I haven't seen a copy of this book
it is
since
so
it's
new.
Been out. Well, I would suggest a copy of the Tao Te Ching, which is the kind of the essential expression of Taoist thought. There are lots of good copies available. I happen to have a version available, and that's in my book, A Path and a Practice. That's what I'd recommend. I'd recommend a copy of the Tao Te Ching and a copy of the Tao of Forgiveness, because my explorations in forgiveness are deeply rooted in the philosophy of the Tao Te Ching.
Well, this book had an interesting origin, I think, as it the idea of other books had their own way of kind of presenting themselves to you, and you thought, oh, this is a good idea for a book. But this book, actually, you had input from people all over the world, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Well, actually, I was approached by the publisher to write a book on the Tao of Forgiveness. That wasn't kind of my idea.
Well, because you've had a lot of successful books based on the Tao Te Ching. And so if I were a publisher, I'd say, hey, Bill, what about another book?
So I said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then I went, I began an email class. I have students around the country and around the world that I kind of keep in touch with. And we explored the whole idea of forgiveness for about 3 months together. And that exploration was extremely helpful to me. I'm very grateful to those. Now, we're about 35 students around the world that really delved into their problems with forgiveness and their understanding of forgiveness, and we wrote back and forth and explored it. It helped me put the stories together that
yeah, because your book has stories that come from classical literature and then your own experiences. But you know what I really enjoyed was your introduction, particularly since we are probably in the same decade of life. And you mentioned that how the Tao Te Ching, as you went through your 20s and your 30s, you were a different person as you became older and your 50s. And you said, well, this, as far as this last, I'll let you know how this one turns out.
Yeah.
But you also say that that the advice that that writers are always given is write what you know.
Yes.
And this is the first myth that you explode in your book.
Well, I hope I explode lots of myths. That's kind of what my life is about, exploding my own myths. That's another good definition of Zen. Explode your own myths and come to a direct experience. But I'll just read this paragraph.
Yeah, do that.
Because it was, some experts on the craft of writing advise write what you know. I've spent my career writing about all the things I don't know. I wrote a book on parenting when the only thing I knew was every possible mistake a parent can make. I wrote about love between two people, a mystery that no one could possibly really know anything about. And I wrote about growing old with grace and courage, and I'll let you know how that turns out. And then here in my early 60s, I'm given the opportunity to look at Lao Tzu again from the idea of forgiveness, and I don't know what I'm talking about. I'll figure it out as I go along. It's interesting. You say, I write this wisdom, and a reader reads it and hears it from their own perspective. When I read it, I hear it from my own perspective. Whenever I'm uncomfortable with the term wisdom literature, but that's in a sense what I write. And I tend to write what I don't know. And I read it a few years later and sense that there actually is some wisdom there, but it's wisdom that escaped me at the time. I write about what I what I would like to experience in my life, but usually about 5 years ahead of actually experiencing it.
Well, you probably heard the expression that we teach what we want to learn.
That's exactly right.
And your writing is a way of exploring and figuring this out for yourself.
It is. It's a way of exploring for me.
My guest is Taoist scholar and Zen teacher Bill Martin. And we're talking about his newest book, The Tao of Forgiveness. And he explained that he went against the advice of write what you know. But you've set your book up. You have stories. You have questions for people to reflect on the story and their own life and meditations. Give us an example of, and I'd particularly like you to read the story about the sparrow.
Okay.
And this one also immediately, this rang so true when I read this story. Bill, go ahead and read that story.
All right. The title of the chapter is A Sparrow Falls, and the subtitle is Only the Broken Heart is an Open Heart. 9-year-old Tommy was free to roam the forests around his home and was ably coached by various adults in the practice of hunting. He occasionally accompanied his father and uncles on pheasant hunts, but had never shot anything himself. One day he was wandering a forest road near his home with his new BB gun. He spotted a sparrow in a nearby branch and immediately aimed and fired. The sparrow fell from the tree and flopped, wounded, into the tall grass. He ran over and found it huddled in the grass, its wings askew, its eyes wide, its heart beating furiously. He could tell it was suffering, and the sight froze his own 9-year-old heart. This was not food, this was suffering. He knew he had to end its misery, so he shot it again. Still it lived. He had to shoot it several times at close range to end the suffering. By that time he was crying so that he could hardly see. He picked it up by a wing and carried it back to his house. His father saw him crying and asked him what had happened. Tommy showed his father the sparrow and told him between sobs what he had done. His father put his hand on Tommy's shoulder and said, "It really hurts your heart, doesn't it, Tommy?" Tommy sobbed an affirmative. His father went on, "You are not a bad person. You needed to learn for yourself how harmful our actions can be. It's only by knowing this that you will develop true kindness. Do you think you will ever shoot a bird for no reason again?" "Never," Tommy said. "Then this little bird died so that many others wouldn't have to. Let's bury him and thank him." They did.
This is Bill Martin is reading from his book, The Tao of Forgiveness. And it's including in his book are stories, but also exercises. This is practical things you can sit down, reflect on the story, the parable that they, mm-hmm. the readers just thought about, reflect on the questions that you present. And also you have meditations and kind of poetry form. So you've kind of stuck with the Tao's style.
Yeah, I hope so. Because it's, again, because the whole idea of forgiveness is nonlinear. And I've done some linear writing to try to explain myself, but I also wanted to try to capture the poetic, mysterious quality of it through the exercises and poems and so on.
My guest has been Bill Martin. His book is The Tao of Forgiveness. And you can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Nancy.
Humorist Eric Miller is known to many readers of his columns in the Chico Enterprise Record as Etc. Guy. He also writes features on business, the environment, and sports for various magazines. He wrote a book called Etc. Guy, Let Me Tell You a Story. Eric, what story do you have for us today?
Nancy, this one's about the Thanksgiving pressures, or how the pressures during the holidays of not eating too much and getting too chubby, of which I have a problem. So this story is entitled Fooey. Let's gain weight over Thanksgiving. So I'll start this with a quote from Ina Garten. She's on the Food Network, host of the Barefoot Contessa. If you think about a Thanksgiving dinner, it's really like making a large chicken. So here we go. It's not the minutes that put on weight, it's the seconds. I'm unsure who said that, but whoever said it was right. Hardly 3 weeks have passed since my final raid on the kids' Halloween candy. My body weight has inched up and out, with muffin tops laying over my jean tops, a new seasonal baseline for my waistline. One of my life's goals is to have a smaller waistline number than inseam number. I should forget about it during Thanksgiving because I'm definitely not getting taller. Like many Americans, we indulge in typical fare. Turkey, dressing, mashed potatoes, gravy, pumpkin pie, the works. At mealtime, an unfinished game of Scrabble usually sits on a tabletop in front of an unfinished football game on TV. My wife cooks up a tasty bird, but this year her mom and my youngest daughter, Maggie, have the honors. Maggie, a ninth grader, is a good cook but very linear when it comes to implementing a menu. She's a sequence chef who methodically prepares one dish at a time. Left without oversight, Maggie's mashed potatoes would leave the stove 4 hours after the bird was already consumed. 2 hours after the mashed potatoes, she'd follow with vegetables, then pumpkin pie another hour or two later. Thanksgiving dinner preparation has the potential of lasting into Black Friday breakfast, a cereal affair. My parents are visiting this Thanksgiving, but Mom isn't a playmaker in the kitchen. My siblings and I never understood her methods or rationale when we were growing up. But we didn't complain. We just assumed that air compressors, torches, and ball-peen hammers were part of her toolkit for making turkey. A few years ago, we started a new family Thanksgiving tradition, participating in a local turkey trot. The Run for Food 5K is a good cause and benefits a faith-based organization that feeds the needy. The irony in this 5K event is that many of us who race aren't running. A few hardcore folks wear computer chips to record their times and actually break a sweat. But for the rest of the pack, it's more of a community group hug and waddle. I'm competitive, though. I want to beat last year's time of 77 minutes. I'm grateful for many things this Thanksgiving. The economy could be better, but several work projects have promise. We have a roof over our heads, our cars work, my parents are healthy enough to visit, and my kids are young enough to stay home. And now I remember most of my computer passwords. I don't care if it is the seconds that put on calories. I'll eventually work them off. For tomorrow, I'll wear stretchy sweatpants. It's the minutes and hours with family I'll count. Happy Thanksgiving.
And thank you, Eric.
Thanks.
Humorist Eric Miller is also known as Etc. Guy.
I'd also like to thank my first guests, Jude Stewart, who wrote a guidebook to smell, and Taoist scholar Bill Martin on forgiveness.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.